Good evening, everybody. It's really nice to be down here. It's actually my first time in this center down here, and it's really nice to see it. I'm a longtime fan of Gil's and sat with him many times, but I just haven't made it to the center yet. And it's wonderful. You guys have a real special place down here. Feels a bit... It's quite an honor to be sitting in the seat where Gil's been sitting so often because I'm a very big fan of Gil's. Tonight I wanted to talk about being with or sitting with what is, with what is happening, with what is in the minute and also what is in the really big sort of macro vision that we have. And when I got a call last month asking if I would give a talk down here on November 4th, this topic immediately popped in my mind because I realized it would be 2 days after the election. And so we're all now sitting with that, this sort of global group reality that has been part of our experience for months now and sort of culminated a couple of nights ago. And I imagine there is some reactivity to it. I know there is for myself, and I imagine there is for many, if not all of us. And I imagine that reactivity could vary some, too, which is great. I actually, though, as excited, I have to admit, I was a Kerry. I'm a fairly big Kerry supporter, or more appropriately, I might say I'm a very big anti-Bush supporter. And 2 days ago, it looked like Kerry might actually pull this out, and I thought, well, this is going to ruin my talk a little bit because I really sort of want it's because it's easier to sit with things that I find comfortable than to sit with things I find uncomfortable. And part of what I wanted to talk about tonight is really learning how to sit with things that maybe might not be so comfortable for us. And so this is particularly pertaining to myself. But I also open this up and totally respect and honor people that might be very happy about what's happened out of the election. Because right now, there are like 58 million people in this country that are very happy and that are, their reactivity to this is that might be extremely different than what mine is and some of ours is. And it could vary certainly in this room. But whatever that is, this still pertains to what I want to talk a bit about tonight. And it's just learning how to sit with what is, what we don't have much control over, and how do we respond to it? How do we react to it? How do we use it? How do we learn from it? Can we be at peace with our reactivity, with circumstances that are beyond our control? Can we be in harmony with these things, with these events that we don't have much control over? I think there's an opportunity to really let the Dharma be alive in these situations. There's an opportunity for the Dharma to be alive in all of our situations and all of our life, but in something that really charges us emotionally or has that possibility, and certainly something that has the possibility to charge us emotionally as a group, can we learn to maybe feel the aliveness of the Dharma within that and to use the tools and the teachings of the Dharma, to use the blessings of the Dharma to help guide us and to help us grow, to help us learn in this? Can we do it in ways that are skillful and in ways that are compassionate? So in thinking about this tonight, there are all these different aspects of the Dharma that came into play for me. So it's a bit of, I was telling people earlier, it's a bit of a smorgasbord of Dharma tonight that can pertain with learning to sit with what is. How do we sit with these emotions, with these feelings, with these reactions to what's just gone on in our country? I mentioned, you know, that there's like 58 million people that are very happy and 55 million people that might be having a fair amount of despair, and that I fall more into the despair and the disappointment category. My parents were just visiting from Kansas, and they like Bush, and they're very happy about it. And I imagine in the last day or so, they've been experiencing some joy, some relief, maybe some feelings of security, maybe feeling a bit safe, maybe feeling that sort of sweet joy of having your side win. It's like when you're on a, if you're like a 49ers fan or a San Francisco Giants fan or a Red Sox fan, there's that joy that comes with winning. So maybe they're feeling a bit of that. And these are my parents. I woke up yesterday and felt a lot of heaviness, a lot of disappointment, a lot of anger, depression. I felt depression. I felt lost. And so within my own family, there are these different reactions to something that's happened. Within these different reactions, there's the opportunity to get a glimpse of dukkha, or a big taste of dukkha, a big taste of suffering sometimes. I was suffering a lot from something that happened that I had no direct control over. I mean, I went out and I worked for it, and I donated money, and I made phone calls, but still, I just had to sit there and be with what occurred in this country. The dukkha from that, for me, the suffering for that, for me, comes around from wanting something else to happen. I wasn't quite prepared for what did happen. The possibility of dukkha for my parents comes from the fact that this sweetness that they might be feeling, or this joy, or this happiness, is also impermanent, is also elusive, will also change over time. So within our reactions, if we cling to an idea or an ideal or a wish for something to happen, we're setting ourselves up for extra suffering that we really don't, that is optional. I mentioned the macro and the micro. How do we sit with the moment, with each present moment as it happens? We've been sitting here in silence for the last half hour. And it's a practice I love, and it's sort of a peculiar practice. Because for me, a lot of what I'm called upon to do as I sit in meditation is, how do I respond to things I don't have much control over? How do I respond to the body pains that might arise, the emotional states that come and go, the ceaseless thoughts that sometimes just go on and on, that I don't think, okay, I'm going to think about this for a while. It just occurs. So I'm sitting here, and all these things happen that really I am not in charge of, that just sort of occur. How do I react to it? Can I sit in harmony with it? Can I sit with acceptance with it? Or do I desire for something else to happen? Do I look for something else? Do I plan for something else? Do I add that extra layer of wanting and desire and thirst on top of that that creates this extra suffering from just being here with what is happening in this moment? So this is the practice we do as we sit in meditation. But what I'm suggesting is that we carry this practice into the larger scale. And when something happens to us as a group, as a country, on a planetary level even, this election was, how do we sit with that? How do we use that? How do we sit in harmony, in acceptance with that, in ways that are skillful and could be helpful for us and for others? One thing I do as I sit in a formal practice in meditation is that I pay close attention to the felt sense of what is occurring in the body. So I really try to pay close attention to the temperature, the vibration, the tug and pull, the expansion, the contraction, the tingling, the minute details of what the felt sense is of whatever is occurring in the body. It really helps sort of ground me, and it also can be very helpful in taking me out of the story about what that particular pain might be, what that particular emotional state might be, and really take me into the felt sense of what is happening, what is happening in this moment. I think this can also be a useful tool, a useful practice in the larger scale too. So, as I sat and watched the election results, every so often I could just sort of come back in and say, what does this feel like? What does this feel like in my body? This takes me to another area of what is happening now, what is this moment, what is this existence, and that is the level of impermanence. When I come into the felt sense in the body, I realize that things are always changing. There's a lot of movement. Sometimes the movement's very subtle, but there's a real sense that things aren't solid, that things move, that there is this level of impermanence underneath all of this. It also helped me with the election in that sense. This too is impermanent. You know, I'm old enough now to live through a number of these elections. And I'll get into that more later. But before I get into impermanence too much, I want to talk about what the Buddha called the eight worldly concerns, or the eight worldly winds. These are what we sort of put our attention on to that sort of take us away from the present moment oftentimes. And they pertain a lot to the whole election process and the whole thing that we've been through as this country for the last year plus. The eight worldly concerns and the eight worldly winds are these. The Buddha talked of gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and disgrace, pleasure and pain. They're really sort of four little yin and yangs that sort of the two sides of these different worldly concerns, the gain and the loss. The praise and the blame, the fame and the disgrace. This whole election process we've been through has just been filled with this. And we can watch the rides that come. Bush is on the top of the polls. Bush is going down on the polls. Kerry comes in and makes a good debate. He's on top. Kerry says a gay comment about the Cheney child. He goes back down. It's all this praise and blame, gain and loss, that this ride that just goes on and on. Very, very obvious in this process in a way. The Buddha warned us about letting these concerns dominate our lives. But he also pointed to the fact that they really point to impermanence. Gain doesn't stay. Loss doesn't stay. These are momentary states that pass through. I seem to have lived a lot of my life looking for praise, looking for gain. I want those. I cling for those. They don't stay. They're impermanent. Continuing in the smorgasbord of Dharma that I'm giving out tonight, and I want to get more into impermanence. But I also want to say, as I throw these things out, I'm just trying to give ways to look at some of the responses you might have had in the room to what's gone on, and ways to use the Dharma to help like I said before, to learn, to cope, to deal, to grow, and to have the Dharma be alive. So, if the worldly concerns struck a little bit of curiosity for you, all of the things I'm talking about could be a night talk, a week talk, a lecture series almost. So there's more depth to what I'm bringing out tonight. So I encourage you to pursue and to look into this if anything raises some energy for you. Learning to live with what is. The Buddha talked a lot about what is. He talked about the three characteristics of existence, the three marks of existence, the first of which is impermanence. All of our existence is permeated with impermanence. This is what we have to sit with. This is what is. That's when, like I said before, the body sensations I find such a rich place to pay attention to, because they really point to impermanence a lot of times. And coming down here tonight, I remembered sitting with Gil 11, 12 years ago. And it was lifetimes ago. All that's gone. What I was doing this morning is gone. You know, the sit we did a half an hour ago is gone. The first half of my talk is gone. It's just everything just falls away. I found myself being concerned about 4 more years of this administration, and I realized that's impermanent. I think the first election I voted in was the 72 election when Nixon got 4 more years. And I thought, oh my God, how awful. Well, it turned out that Nixon had 3 more years and his vice president had 2 more years. We didn't know that at the time. We didn't even know the quality of that impermanence when that happened. So we have no idea what's going to happen now. So the first characteristic of the three characteristics of existence is impermanence. The second of these is dukkha, or suffering. I talked a bit about the suffering that comes from my own desire from wanting the election to be other than it was, that extra suffering. I was reading the other day this description of dukkha. Birth is dukkha, aging is dukkha, death is dukkha, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair are dukkha. Not getting what is wanted is dukkha. It is suffering. In this world of change and impermanence, could it be there's no safe place to really rest? Or do we rest in this world of impermanence? Do we rest in this world of change? The third characteristic is anatta, or not self. Again, this is a topic that could be quite a long study in and of itself. But I just want to say this about it. To see the world in its true nature is to see that the three characteristics inherent with all things, that the world is a place of suffering and dissatisfaction, that nothing stands still, and that however hard you look, you will never find a permanent self. In this world of constant change, what is permanent about the self? And I bring this, the third of the three characteristics of existence, into this conversation tonight, because with a strong sense of self, the level of suffering that can happen, to me, just increases. Because it becomes all of a sudden this election happened to me and I didn't get what I wanted. My vision is not the vision of the country. And the more that I had this sense of self, the more I'm at conflict with what's going on in this moment. The more that things just are the way they are, the less I have identification with it. The more things can just flow, the more I can be at peace with this moment, the more I can be in harmony with this moment, the more I can be in acceptance and allowance with this moment. And then there's really an opportunity to be alive, to be responsive, to be compassionate, to be here. How do we respond to the moment? How do we respond to what's happening right now? The Buddha talked a lot about this, and one area that I have found very helpful are the Brahmaviharas. The Brahmaviharas, also known as the heavenly abodes, are they're developed virtues that are conducive to noble living. There's sort of a framework of behavior that the Buddha laid out for us that he encourages us to follow that are really conducive to noble living. I'll quickly go over the first three. The first one is metta, loving kindness, the practice of loving kindness. The second is karuna, or compassion, the kindness shown to those who suffer. The third is mudita, or sympathetic joy, being happy for others, enjoying the joy of others, not feeling envy. But the fourth I find the most pertinent for what I'm talking about tonight, and that's upeka, or equanimity. Can we find equanimity, or peacefulness, or like a dispassion for what is happening in this moment, an equanimity to be here with whatever is occurring with openness, the ability to accept the ups and downs of life with equal dispassion? It's really sort of not being moved by the eight worldly concerns. So I hear the election results. I have these very felt responses, these very strong emotional responses to what's happening. And I look, can I be equanimous with it? Can I be here, and even equanimous with my strong emotional states that arise with it? To allow them to be, to feel them, to honor them, but to not be moved, to be unperturbed by them. I think there's a misconception that equanimity is about sitting around while things happen and not doing anything, when actually it's really quite the opposite. The Buddha once said, those who are at peace are abundant in energy. Inaction and silence in the face of injustice and cruelty is not a sign of equanimity, but rather a lack of it. It is a sign of cowardice. Equanimity is based on the feeling of power. Cowardice is based on the feeling of powerlessness. So it's from this place of equanimity that maybe we can find our strong voice, our true calling, our true call to action, what needs to be done. How do we respond appropriately with what is happening in the present moment? How do we respond as we sit in meditation to the small details of our experience, to the body pains and emotions? How do we respond to the large things that affect us all? Social injustice, poverty, the environment, global warming, the war in Iraq. Equanimity is based on the feeling of power. Cowardice is based on the feeling of powerlessness. So maybe to try to find that energy in this equanimous, unperturbed state. Sometimes in great turmoil, I've had the experience of watching really beautiful things happen. I lived in New York in the 80s, And New York, like San Francisco, was really sort of ground zero for AIDS. And being a gay man, I watched this horrible devastation go on in my community. I watched, I don't know how many people die. And this went on for 15 years. And at the same time, especially in the 80s, the government was doing nothing about it. Reagan didn't say the word AIDS for his first 6 years in office. The New York Times didn't put it on the front page of the paper for about 3 years until there were over, I think, about 5,000 gay men dead, whereas the Tylenol scare, where 4 people died or 8 people died, was on the front page for 30 days. So I sat there and I watched this injustice happen, but at the same time, I watched this community develop that went out and cared for people, that developed healthcare organizations and hospices and food programs, and all of these things developed in the midst of this unbelievable ugliness, and all these things that developed out of this action of the heart that was just really beautiful. Some of the most beautiful stuff I've ever seen. Some connections I've had with community and with people, the likes of which I've never really quite experienced since. In the midst of this great turmoil and brutal ugliness. So I bring this up tonight in case there's some feeling of despair, of hopelessness, or of, you know, whatever, that we never really know what's going to arise out of this present moment. We never know what's going to grow out of it. What can flower? The lotus flowers in basically ponds of garbage, you know. And Steve was showing me this beautiful new Buddha statue out there of the first Buddhist nun. She's on top of this beautiful lotus. Lotuses grow in shit, basically. Excuse my language, I'm on tape. So, now, and the other thing I want to say, I realize there might be some reactions in the room. There might be some people that are really joyous about what happened. Bush really, really speaks to a lot of people, and I respect that. I have to. He speaks to my parents. And in thinking about that, I was thinking, you know, well, my parents are educated, you know, successful, well-read people. But then I was thinking, boy, even that thought is a little bit, oh, there's something uncomfortable about that thought even, because it doesn't matter who, it doesn't matter if my parents were, you know, high, you know, dropped out of grade school or something, or, you know, were poor southerners or whatever. All of our reactions are legitimate, and all our reactions are deserve to be honored in this. To me, the lesson for all of us in this time, which has been very divisive, is to look for the lessons of the Dharma in this, no matter what our reactions are. And a big one is to really look for the reaction of them and us. They are wrong, I am right. They are fucking things up, my side will make things better. It's not them and us, it's us. Buddha was really clear about that. So no matter what your reactions are, to be careful around that, to look at that. Is there a demonization going on in the midst of our reactive state to what is happening, to what's our reaction to what's to this moment, to this time? So, I think this is a great opportunity to practice in a community, to practice with the large response, while we also practice with our small inward meditative responses, to feel the Dharma alive, to feel that, to go back and look, how are the eight worldly concerns playing into this? Where is praise and blame? Where is gain and loss? How are the three characteristics of existence playing into this? How does impermanence play into this? How does suffering play into this? How does my sense of self play into this? Am I adding to my suffering by my reaction? And can I find some level of equanimity in the midst of all of this? Can it just be? It's a great opportunity for practice. It's a great opportunity for investigation. It's a great opportunity to see the Dharma that I take it we all love because we're here, at play in the world, alive in the world. Well, this is what I prepared to talk about tonight. And at this point, I'd like to open it up for discussion, for comments, for feedback, for reflections, for reactions that people might have had to what we're going through.
I would really like to see if Carrie wanted to hear you talk about that.
Yeah.
Carrie wouldn't just.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Alternate universe.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
yeah.
What would you talk to me about?
Well, yeah, let's see if I can make one up real fast.
I've been disappointed because it would change the course of what you plan to say and talk about acceptance. You'd be disappointed because you wouldn't have had a thing to talk about acceptance, for sure.
Well,
right?
For me, acceptance is much easier when things are pleasurable or when I feel like things are going my way. If I'm on a meditation retreat, if I'm sitting in meditation, it's so much easier for me to sit if I'm calm, if I'm peaceful, if my mind's not too active, if my body is responding appropriately. It's so much easier. And it's like, oh my God, meditation's so easy. This is great. I got it down. I got it figured out. But, you know, throw in some body pain, throw in some strong emotional state, throw in, you know, all of a sudden a memory of a big fight I had, and there's a lot of anger and a lot of juice, and it's like, oh my God, I hate this. How much longer is this sit going to go on? You know, is the clock ever going to end? That's, you know, this is an interesting play. But, so, it becomes easier to talk about the difficult, you know, the difficult time to sit. Although it works just the same on the other side. I'm fooled in meditation if I think I have it down. If I think it's all going well, if I think I get it, I don't get it then, you know. It's just to be with what is, and to not say, this is it, this is permanent, now I understand it. It's just like, oh, now this is happening, now there's this experience going on. And to allow it. At the same time, I think it's really important to feel that, the joy of the good times, to really feel it, to allow it, to accept it, to enjoy it, which probably would have been part of the Carrie talk, to really say, oh my God, my body feels light, I feel tall, I feel energized, I feel hopeful, all of these impermanent thoughts, feelings, emotions that would just be rushing through me at that time, to really enjoy that without clinging to them, without owning them, without putting my sense of self on them, and to let them go, and to let them be, run their course. I've done a number of long retreats now, and it's taken me a while to get it down to the point where there are moments sometimes of really deep, intense joy. And when that first started happening for me, I was just like, oh, I want this. I want this. I'm just like, oh, this is so great. And then as soon as I start to do that, it would change and it would move away quicker. But I find if I can just sort of sit there and say, and enjoy it, it's a bit tricky because part of it stays around longer if I don't try to grab onto it so much. There's still a bit of play going on with it, I fear. But just to allow it. And also on the same side of that, we also have to allow and honor and accept our feelings of despair, of hopelessness, of anger, and sit fully with that at the same time. I think both are important. And as soon as we start denying that, we are not in harmony. We are not at peace with it, with our present moment. So that's part of it. Wouldn't have been as interesting of a talk. I could have had my parents in, yeah. Or my brother. Yeah. I have a gay Republican brother that I just do not understand. But it's been a good lesson for me. And one thing I thought about saying tonight was, I often think, what does the Dalai Lama do? You know, that's always a good point of reference. And talk about somebody who's gone through political upheaval, being exiled from his country, watching his culture destroyed, watching his monasteries destroyed, and yet he's the happiest man I've ever seen in my life, I would say. He calls the Chinese, I've heard him call them two different things, my friend the enemy, or the enemy my teacher. So what do we have to learn? No matter what side of the fence, if you're a Bush supporter, what can Kerry teach you? What can the Kerry supporters teach you? And from the Kerry side, you know, what can Cheney teach you? You know, it's a good thing to consider. It's a good thing to think about. It's not always easy. It's not always easy for me, I have to say. So. I thought a bit tonight about doing an exercise and having everybody shut their eyes and then saying, okay, now, you know, be in the body and feel, really feel George W. Bush as the president and George and Dick are around for 4 more years. What does that feel like in the body? You know, what can we learn from our reactions? Anybody else? Cheryl.
I liked what you said earlier about the word play, as in watching a play, being part of a play, came through, and it was, you went on to elaborate on a slightly different point, but what caught me was this beautiful moment of the ability to disengage from what's happening long enough to recognize what is happening, but then to, like, the second part of that is to actually embrace what's happening. As if, yes, I feel angry, but I'm not just lost in my anger out here. I'm able to step back in this play, looking at what's happening, and then as the actor, get right back into it and go, oh yeah, that's my line. That's what I'm supposed to be doing now. Oh, okay. You know what I mean? It's like
right.
I embody more fully, more consciously, the emotion, as opposed to just being kind of swept around by it, not knowing what the heck is going to go on and where is it going to lead.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So it for some reason, it really snapped for me when you used that terminology, just like, oh, this is like a play. Oh, I get it.
Yeah.
So I'm not taking that from it completely. I'm still part of it, but I'm able to stand back for just a brief moment.
Right. It's also an opportunity to play, you know.
To play. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. To play with our practice, you know, which is our lives, and, you know, in essence, or whatever.
You
that loving kindness would work?
Not recently. Have you?
Oh, this morning.
Good. Yeah. Was it helpful?
Oh, I every morning I do loving kindness, and it's the whole sequence, you know, doing it for myself, for teachers and benefactors and loved ones and neutral people. These are cashiers at the cafeteria I do that for. And then the people I feel animosity and go through with Bush, Cheney, and people in all Qaeda. If you go, I mean, you generate feelings of good wishes, and you have that feeling, then it's easy to spread it. Once you go through the other stuff, you have the energy to do it, then to spread it to Bush and Cheney. I mean, because you got to look at the opposite. You really want to be vindictive, and you really want them to suffer or something like that. No, I think we want their ideologies to be different, but we don't want them to suffer. But we're not going to have joy if they get sick or something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so it's sending those good wishes. I mean, want him to be happy, be happy with his family.
Have you
that way? It's easy to do.
Have you noticed a change on how you feel about him from doing that?
I've known him for a while, not just recently.
Right, that's what I'm curious.
It was never personal. I mean, I thought some of his answers and debates, you really see into his heart as being really sincere.
Mm. Right. I find that helpful to see that too. Yeah. No, thanks for bringing that up, because that's a wonderful practice to do. To another way to handle difficult emotions, and to there's always sort of a rewiring, I think, that goes on when we practice loving kindness.
Yeah, and I encourage people, if you have difficulty doing it, don't do it. Just go with the stuff that feels comfortable, and that builds up, and you know. Maybe your neighbor who looked at you the wrong way thought of that way.
Right. Please.
After the invasion of Afghanistan, there was a gathering here, and Gil was sort of comforting us because a lot of people had put in a lot of work with the hopes that the bombing wouldn't happen. And he focused a lot on talking about how no good is ever wasted. Those efforts that we make touch the people around
right.
us. And
right.
I feel that way now. And I got an email that was from the Peace and Justice Forum about it. I talked tomorrow night about, okay, the election's over, what now? And it really sort of made me feel good, because I went to Nevada and I interacted with people and I got to know some really cool people.
Hmm.
And that'll go forward and that affects lives. And what we do now afterwards and how we're touching each other, that affects lives too. So it's not all about the big who won the election.
Right, right. That's beautiful, thank you, yeah. Yeah, it feels like there's a definite feel to it, but it's not. It's much broader and more encompassing than a defining moment.
And they would be sure to bring those ballots to somebody they did trust.
Mm.
And the sign they had, you must vote. You know, it was something.
It's great you both left the state to work. I find that, you know, very encouraging too. Did you encounter adversity?
Yes, with the person who I was.
Oh.
But thank God I was able to hook her once I got back, I think so.
Mm.
But always, you know, without this kind of a practice, things would be so up and off the walls, out of control.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This is very helpful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm really curious. Did your brother vote for Bush?
You know, I haven't asked him. I felt like I didn't have to ask him because he lived in Chicago, and I know the way Chicago votes, and so I didn't feel like I had to pressure him to mm-hmm. vote the way I wanted him to. Mm-hmm. If he lived in Ohio, I would have been on his case. So it was like, but you know, it's a bit like living in San Francisco. It doesn't quite have the same urgency. Yeah, I find it very helpful to constantly gauge where my own reactivity comes from and where my own beliefs come from. You know, I'm a white, middle-class, Midwesterner, gay kid that grew up in the 60s. So I hold a lot of these values. Which I'd have extremely different views, I'm sure, if I was born in Southeast Asia, if I was born in Africa, if I was born in the South, If I was born black, if I was born a woman, if I was born in the 20s, if I was born in the 90s, you know, my views could be totally different. So I think like a gay hippie, because that's sort of what I am, you know. And it makes sense to me. And I think my views hold a lot of water, and they seem very true to me. I mean, you know, I believe in the environment. I believe in Buddhism, you know, so it just makes so much sense to me. And why doesn't everybody? Because these are the right views. It's like, well, you know, it's my conditioning. So do I blame somebody else for not being born into what I was born into? It's like, you know, I do, but I shouldn't. And I try to catch myself around that. So it's really important to watch our own views and to watch how much we judge somebody else for their views, I think, sometimes. And there's a lot of people, I mean, one thing that really became clear this election was people were voting on faith and moral values. And, I feel it's unfortunate because they get sort of muddy and they go off in ways, I mean, I'm the brunt of that sometimes being a gay person, because I think a big thing that swung this election, one of the brilliant things Karl Rove did, he tied gay marriage into this. It was a big deciding factor in this election. Homosexuals don't get married, you know, and the country's going to hell in a handbasket. Which is this also, to me, part of a feeling around people have moral, people have spiritual yearnings. We want to feel connected. We want to feel like things mean something, like our laws mean something, like, you know, I think we all have these moral yearnings. And so, I don't know, it gets a little perverted or whatever, but in a way it's not a bad thing. Dennis Kucinich was saying, you know, we had the separation of church and state, but we take it so far sometimes that we pull the spirituality out of all of our decisions. And it can't be pulled out of our decisions. It has to be part of how we make decisions as a government. So, you know, My sister's on the school board in Kansas, and she has been for a while. My sister ran against a person who said that the Earth is 3,000 years old and that the dinosaurs are a myth. And that person didn't win, but there's enough people on the school board in the state that do believe that, that have won, that 4 or 8 years ago they took evolution out of the high school yearbooks. My sister got in with some other people, they put it back in the yearbooks, and now it's back out again, or out of the textbooks. So, you know, this play of our spiritual moral values is a funny one. So I don't, they should put it in the textbooks that, you know, we're reborn a billion times, that we all were related, that we all were each other's brothers, mothers, sisters, fathers, sons, you know. I want that in the high school textbooks. I'm rambling here.
It's more subtle than that, because I'm an engineer, and when we run tests and stuff, something happens, we all have our own opinions, what happened. This is something personal, it's not like politics. And I say in my mind how it clings, oh, it happened this way, it happened this way. And I ask, well, what makes me think it happened this way? This is something that the mind grabs out on. And that's something very impersonal, so. And you get into politics, and it gets really personal.
Mm.
I think it's just a habit of the mind to do that, to order things and understand things.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny how we think, oh, now we understand it. I was reading a while ago that, I don't know when the atoms were really discovered, or then they found atoms, this the smallest particle of matter, the atom. And that was the knowledge, and we thought that's it for a while, but now they, oh no, atoms are made up of things, you know, and so it's like, no, that's, so now we think we have it again. So it, and that's been sort of the history of science, hasn't it? Oh, now this is it. No, now this is it. No, this is it, you know, it's like, yeah. It's what we experience when we sit, or what I sometimes do. Oh, now I get it. Watch out for that.
After a while, it does click in to see you doing that.
Well, what? That you do get it?
No. If you click in, you go, if when you say, oh, I got it, you go, oh, I said that all the time.
Yeah, yeah. We have a few minutes left. Is there anybody else has any comments or anything?
Louis, you should say something. As a senior hippie here, you should
say. Well, I feel like I rambled a little bit tonight, but I really wanted to talk on what I've been hearing from my community around dealing with what's happened in this country. And again, to bring sort of a smorgasbord of the Dharma into it and to show you, you know, there's all these different ways we can approach this. And I just barely touched on some. I personally really like my Dharma to be practical. How does this help me in my life? How does this help me moment to moment? How can I, in a sense, taste it in any moment? So I try to, it's my hope that I've brought some, I've sparked maybe some ideas that could be helpful to other people, and that it could be avenues of exploration, of consideration, or whatever. That we can deal with ourselves and with the community and with the people we disagree with equanimity, with compassion. That we watch how we get caught up in our sense of self and in the worldly play. I don't know if this is a tradition here, but it's something I like to do. And if we could just sit for another moment and dedicate our practice here together. And take just a moment to notice the felt sense of the body right now. What kind of energy? What's the feeling state? It's our presence, our aliveness. Our capacity for clear seeing and understanding. This beautiful practice that we do and share. May this practice that we share, that we have shared together tonight, may it be a benefit for all people. For Republicans, for Democrats, for Independents, for Green Party, for Muslims, Buddhists, Christians, Jews. May all beings benefit from the merit of our practice. May all beings know safety and security. May all beings learn to live together. May all beings be happy.